How can we envision the sweeping changes to entire landscapes?
Ownership of commons, the air, soils, water, biological diversity, back
cultural
to the
diversity is as
severe
critical as biological
disorientation. In this epic struggle to preserve a habitable
that
planet,
is the only thing which is sustained.
Every place that you love is now under siege.
Deregulated commerce is becoming a threat to the life on this planet.
These are system problems.
Our humanity is
we shouldn't ask whether we can survive.
These are existential
or
questions
not.
As much as they are systemic questions.
Put these
action informed by knowledge of
get down
place.
To work.
You're listening to the Schumacher Conversations, a series of lively discussions featuring some of the foremost voices in the movement for a new economics. The conversations engage prominent E.F. Schumacher speakers as they reflect on past lectures and their enduring relevance given current economic, social, and ecological realities.
Any public program to preserve land or produce food is hopeless if it does not tend to right the balance between numbers of people and acres of land, and to encourage long-term stable connections between families and small farms.
Let's have a look at it.
Nwamaka Agbo and Stacy Mitchell engage in the following Schumacher conversation on August 20th, 2020.
So hello everyone and welcome. Please grab a coffee and a tea and get cozy. We'll be here for the next hour and a half. My name is Neve Leonard and I have the pleasure of being a board member of the Schumacher Center for New Economics. It's truly an honor for me to moderate today's Schumacher conversation with two amazing women I've long admired, Nwamaka Agbo and Stacy Mitchell. So before we begin, I think it's important to acknowledge and recognize the Indigenous peoples who have stewarded the lands on which we live, we work, we play. We're chiming in from all over the world, but I'd like to focus on the context of the place where the Schumacher Center operates. The center is located on lands from which the Mohican people were displaced through the Indian Removal Act, signed into law by President Jackson in 1830. That land, which today is known as the Berkshires, sustains the work of our center. And I think this history is important context to have front of mind as we discuss the need for restorative and decentralized economic models, because we need to better understand the history of our current economics. So the Schumacher Center's annual lecture series is now in its 40th year. For many of us, these lectures have become annual moments of meaning and connection with insightful economic thinkers. This summer, we launched the Schumacher Conversations, a series where pairs of past lecture speakers come together to reflect on how their work has evolved since their lectures and share insights about the present moment. And today we have the pleasure of having Nwamaka Agbo and Stacy Mitchell. Okay. Nwamaka is a restorative economics practitioner who brings a solutions-oriented approach to her project management consulting. She has a background in organizing, electoral campaigns, policy, and advocacy on racial, social, and environmental justice issues. Nwamaka supports projects that build resilient, healthy, and self-determined communities rooted in shared prosperity. She is an associate at the Movement Strategy Center and was a 2017 fellow with the RSC Integrated Capital Fellowship Program. Her work has touched many organizations and communities, transform finance, eco-districts, Thousand Currents, Resource Generation, Restore Oakland, and our very own center where she was a director for several years as well. Very long CV. So Nwamaka lives in Oakland with her husband, where she can be found geeking out on the latest sci-fi, Afrofuturism novels, or cheering for the Golden State Warriors. And Stacy is co-director of the Institute for Local Self-Reliance and directs its independent business initiative, which produces research and analysis and partners with a broad range of allies to design and implement policies to reverse corporate concentration and strengthen local enterprise. Stacy's reports and articles about the dangers of concentrated economic power have influenced policymakers, journalists, and advocates. She has written widely for The Atlantic, Bloomberg, Washington Monthly, and The Wall Street Journal. She's also the author of the book big box swindle. As an advisor to policymakers and grassroots organizations, Stacy has developed and helped enact city, state, and federal policies that level the playing field for independent businesses, curb corporate power, and strengthen communities. So in today's conversation, Uno Maka and Stacy will reflect on their past lectures and on the current moment. And before we dive in, I'd like for each of us to just say a few words about how we're arriving in this moment and what's most salient. It's really been a crazy year. From where I stand in Montreal and Canada, the year started with the Wet'suwet'en people of British Columbia asserting their sovereignty over their territory by blocking the development of a pipeline. Their actions led to acts of solidarity by Indigenous and non-Indigenous people across the country, and also led to a lot of pushback. A month later, in March, North America was hit by the pandemic, which pressed pause on the world as we know it, while bringing profound inequities to light as the virus spread in our communities. George Floyd's murder on May 25th then led to a resurgence of the Black Lives Matter movement globally and directed the conversation towards the systemic racism that continues to exist in our communities, specifically anti-Black racism. And here we are, August 20th, just 229 days into the year, and it is in this context that we are having this conversation today. So Uno Maka and Stacy, before we kick it off, I'd love for you to just say a few words about how you're arriving in this conversation today and what are some of the things that are salient for you that you'd like us to have top of mind as we chat. And Uno Maka, I see you're unmuted. You can start.
I'll jump in. Thank you for the introduction, Niamh, and thank you to the Schumacher Center for New Economics for having us back. And I'm very excited to be in conversation with you today, Stacy. I would offer, in terms of how I'm arriving to the conversation, I think you did an excellent job of really laying out a number of the converging crises that we're seeing, not just in the context of the global north and the United States, but also as it kind of impacts the way we are a true global community. And so I'm just kind of sitting with the heaviness and overwhelmingness of all of that. And in spite of that, I would also say that I'm deeply encouraged to see the ways that communities, local governments are trying to figure out how to come together to support each other and to be in deep and authentic relationship with one another so that we can kind of continue to weather through these crises. So in these moments, I look to the grassroots organizers, I look to the Indigenous communities, I look to neighbors, friends, and family to really be a lot of the hope in terms of how we move forward. So I'm gonna try to lean into that a bit today in the midst of all the ambient stress we're all holding around this moment.
Beautiful. And Stacy, what about you?
I am, as I have been for most of this year, just really all the things, you know, all the emotions of it. I feel in some ways that we're seeing more clearly maybe than we have in the past, and that holds within it possibility. And yet there's so much tragedy, and so much tragedy in the fact that in some cases it's taken us this long to see clearly. So, I'm all the things, but I really, it's an incredible pleasure and to be on the Schumacher Center stage, as it were, and to be in this conversation with Uno Maka, who's it's just really an honor to have this opportunity and, and what I think we can all take away from being in this place together today.
Absolutely. I mean, we're so honored to have you both here. So the format for today is quite simple. So Uno Maka and Stacy will share some reflections about their own lectures for about 10 minutes each. And then, you know, we'd like to have a conversation with all of you. And so we'll all be asking questions from each other, but we'll also be asking your questions, which you can post in the Q&A box at the bottom of your Zoom screen. We'll get to as many as we can in the hour and a half. So Stacy and Uno Maka, both of your lectures, I saw them as really centering on the importance of place and land for the healing of communities. And I'd like to go chronologically. Stacy, your 2006 lecture was called Declarations of Independence. Can you tell the audience a little bit about the lecture and share some of your reflections about it and now looking back with the benefit of 14 years of hindsight?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, Declaration of Independence. I had sort of actually forgotten the title. I did read back, read the lecture again. But I think really it was sort of speaking a little bit about the relationship between democracy and economy, which is, I think, at the center of my work. You know, I think, as I said in the opening, when I think back to that lecture, which was, I guess, 13 years ago now, I do think that we're seeing things more clearly. The center of my work and what that lecture was about to a large degree was about the increasing concentration of economic power. And of course, this is a problem that has only grown worse in the last dozen years. So we have sort of more and more extreme levels of concentrated power. Virtually every industry is in a few hands. More and more the productive capacity of our communities is really held and controlled, removed from us. But I do think that the thing that is striking to me, thinking back to that period of my work versus now, is that we're actually talking more frequently, at any rate, about power and about how our markets are structured. And that's very different. You know, back then, I often felt very hemmed in with the argument or the set of ideas that I wanted to talk about. I felt very hemmed in by having to make that case within a certain framework. And it was a framework that existed really broadly in society, you know, including among progressives. And that framework tended to look at the problems of corporations around corporate behavior. So in the case of like Walmart, for example, the questions, you know, were, you know, is Walmart a bad employer? Do they pay bad wages? If they squeeze suppliers and squeeze workers, are they delivering low prices that somehow make up for that? So everything was sort of about the problem as it was framed, and that, you know, you sort of had to make a case about Walmart within was, you know, how do we make Walmart behave better? You know, and it was sort of always within this like set of like the cost benefit analysis of Walmart, if you will. And so even among people who agreed that Walmart was a problem, it was how do we make Walmart pay more? How do we make Walmart behave differently? And I felt for a long time that that's really the wrong question about any of the kind of private corporations that run so much of our economy and our lives. That the real question has to do with, you know, in the case of Walmart, you know, how is it that we've allowed this one entity to have this much unchecked power? You know, that it isn't, that if we're just dealing with behavior and never dealing with the underlying issue of how decisions are made and who makes them, then we're always in this situation of a kind of whack-a-mole, like whatever the bad behavior is, the pollution, the low wages, what have you, we're always, you know, sort of one step behind and kind of losing as we try to deal with those symptoms instead of the underlying issue. You know, and just to kind of ground this a little bit further and to just kind of continue with the example of Walmart for the sake of having an example, Walmart now captures about one out of every $4 that Americans spend on food. It's extraordinary. There are over 200 metropolitan and micropolitan markets, and micropolitan markets are like small metros. There's small cities and their surrounding area. There are over 200 of those metro areas and micro areas in which Walmart has more than 50% of all food spending. And there are several metro areas where it has more than 70%, 80%, 90%. When you control that much of the food system, both locally and nationally, you basically control how food is produced. If Walmart decides that it, you know, wants, you know, chicken breasts to be smaller, that means that, you know, all the way up the supply chain, we're going to change the breeding of chickens in order to satisfy Walmart. So in effect, Walmart is governing our food system. It's more powerful than the Food and Drug Administration. You know, my local grocer, certainly in my neighborhood grocery market, certainly makes decisions, but their decisions don't govern how a whole industry or a whole system operates. So to me, the question to ask about Walmart, and really always was the question, is not, you know, is their behavior benevolent or evil, But why do we have an autocrat in charge of our food system? We live in a democracy. So, you know, how is it that this came to be? And I think that that this begins to get us to like a clearer picture of what the problem of concentrated economic power is in the context of a democracy or a supposed democracy, an aspiring democracy, I'll say. You know, we have a set of checks and balances within our government where the idea is that you've got these, you know, at the federal level, you've got these three parts of government and they all sort of have a check and balance on one another. Our anti-monopoly laws and our anti-monopoly traditions were designed to work in concert with those checks and balances and to affect to be a check on private power, economic power, and was at various points in our history, you know, understood to be an essential part of how you actually maintain a democracy, that it isn't just about how you structure government, but it's also about whether we have freedom and liberty and equality in the context of the economy, whether we have control over our destiny and the ability to make collective decisions in our own interests in the context of the economy. But we've really lost track of that notion over the last 40 years or so. There was a real turning point in the 1970s, 1980s, where, in the case of our antitrust law in particular, there was this movement of legal scholars and economists who came along and said, all of the things that the law, the antitrust laws have been concerned with, the notion of protecting citizenship, of protecting democracy from concentrated power, of making sure that everyone had opportunity and fair dealing within the economy, whether they were workers or producers or businesses or consumers, that all of the notion of fairness and market structure and democracy that had been part of how we wrote and conceived of our antitrust laws, that none of that really mattered. But the only thing that ought to matter when we think about antitrust is efficiency. And, larger companies, the corollary was, larger companies are inherently more efficient. They will deliver low prices for consumers, and that's the only thing that matters. And with that shift, this sort of, we basically turned antitrust policy on its head through this ideological movement among scholars that then infected the enforcement agencies and the judges and so on, and resulted in a whole change in how we approach that issue. And ever since then, we have been living in this kind of sort of fantasy land, or, this like misguided notion that you have the economy over here and the economy, there are various forces that we read about that are outside of our control. You've got globalization or technological change. You read news stories about the economy and it's often missing actors. There are things that happen, but there are no actors doing anything. And then we have government over here, and government can kind of interfere in the economy, but the economy is like a separate thing that exists on its own. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Like, every kind of a market is created by a set of public rules. The farmer's market in my town is created by a set of decisions that are made about what day it's going to be on, where's the location, who can be there, who can trade, and so on. The market doesn't exist without a set of public rules that enable it. And so markets are always a function of government. And the question really to ask is what kind of markets, what kind of economy, what kind of entities, economic systems are we producing out of that? And so from that viewpoint, Walmart is very much a product of policy. Walmart would not have existed, could not have existed in the 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s before those changes in antitrust law and before a number of other policy developments that I've written about and tracked in my work, that really allowed for, created, and fueled the idea of a single company effectively dominating and controlling the food system all the way down. As I said at the beginning, I think the good news, if I can find some in our present moment, or is that there is more clarity and people are seeing that more clearly. And for any number of reasons, I think in the you know, in the context of COVID and the federal government's failed response across the board, but, you know, in particular, you know, taking in particular on the economy, you know, it's just very obvious that we've, you know, got a spigot of cash that's available out the back door of the Federal Reserve if you're a large company. But if you're a small business or a community or a renter or anybody else, you know, like maybe there's a little bit of help for you, maybe, you know. And, you know, if you're a small business, there's a potential that you could have grabbed onto one of these fleeting loans through the Paycheck Protection Program, which, of course, were only available if you actually had a banking relationship, which meant that if you were a Black-owned or Brown-owned business or rural areas, any number of circumstances, you were just left out of that entirely. So I think that there is something about what has happened in the context of the crises of this year that has just made it much more cut and dry, much more visible and laid bare, I guess is the phrase, of how government chooses and picks winners and losers and picks a kind of economic structure. But, you know, I think this clarity around the issue being fundamentally about power and policy is, I guess, in many respects, I feel, although many of the problems I deal with have gotten worse, that we're actually in a better situation in terms of being able to maybe effectively respond to them. So, you know, one sort of measure of this is just the work that that I and other allies have been doing around trying to recover our anti-monopoly policies and recover antitrust. And so if you go back and look at the 20th century, in every single party platform, virtually both Democrat and Republican, and in almost every State of the Union address from the 1930s up until the 1980s, or at least the 70s, the words antitrust and monopoly appear. It was part of, you know, ongoing set of policy ideas, disappear entirely in the 1980s. And so for almost 30 years, those words, any notion of antitrust or monopoly has not appeared in either party platform, and came back in 2016, have resurfaced. And there has been a growing conversation in the years since about the notion of monopoly, about the notion of private concentrated economic power. And just to close here, I guess the you know, part of what's driven this, I think, new conversation about power, you know, one thing that's made it about economic, concentrated economic power, one thing that I think has really fueled it, it has to do with the tech companies, because they represent, not a new form of monopoly. We've dealt with this form of monopoly in the past, but something that is a more extreme form of it than, say, Walmart. So in the case of Amazon, you've got a company that not only doesn't just simply just want to dominate markets, but actually owns the infrastructure for upon which commerce happens. So most people start their shopping not in a search engine, but they start right on Amazon. Like the vast majority of online commerce happens on Amazon's website. And what that has meant is that every other company that makes or sells anything in our society that wants to reach a customer online has to sell on Amazon's platform, or they give up access to more than 60% of the market right out of the gate. And they have, in effect, become the owner of the railroad. And if you want to reach the market, your goods have to travel on that railroad. And what that enables them to do, because they also compete with those same businesses that depend on them, is to spy on those businesses, to take their best ideas, to levy extremely expensive tolls to ride on their rails, and to systematically use that power and the data that they gather to expand into new markets with a kind of built-in advantage. And that understanding of the nature of Amazon being different and more extreme than, say, Walmart, and more, you know, in effect, what Amazon has done is it has taken open public markets that are governed by public rules and increasingly shifted our commerce into a private arena where it sets the And that, I think, has really woken people up to the problem of sort of autocratic rule and the sort of governing nature of these corporations. And one of the places where we've seen this come out is in the investigation that the House Antitrust Subcommittee has been doing around big tech, which has been sort of an extraordinary illustration of what Congress looks like when it's actually doing its job and really digging in and grappling seriously with a set of problems. There was a hearing last month that is one stage of the investigation that will ultimately result in a report and a set of investigations. And the chairman of the hearing, David Cicilline, who's from Rhode Island, in his closing remarks, he said, "Our founders would not bow before a king, nor should we bow before the emperors of the online economy." So again, this idea that it isn't just about the cost benefit of this big company and are they doing the right thing? It's about who makes decisions, what is the nature of power, and why is it that we have these autocrats in our economy when in fact we're supposedly a democracy? So I will leave it there.
Thank you, Stacey. You know, two things you said really resonated. I think the first one being that in this time, I think we're better equipped because we can see these dynamics more clearly than we have before to address them. I think that that's a big lesson of this year. And then the other thing that I really liked is how you can, you know, one thing that I love about your work is how you really connect democracy and economics and make, you know, you said something about how we need to re-see our liberty and freedom and autonomy within the context of our economics as being inherent to our democracy. And I think that's a really powerful image that I think we need to keep front of mind. So Nwamaka, in 2017, you hosted a Schumacher lecture, which was entitled "A Conversation About Land and Liberation," where you and your guest talk about the interdependence between human and land liberation. And that was only 3 years ago, but so much has happened since. And I'd love for you to tell us a little bit about your lecture and you know, and some of your own work and share some of your reflections about its significance for today.
This is my pleasure. And I'll start off by saying also, Stacey, really appreciate your comments. I think the importance of really being able to interrogate power, policy, and privilege is extremely important as we kind of start to unpack all the convergent crises that we've been talking about. But yes, when I had the pleasure of sharing the Schumacher stage a few years ago, it was in the context of really looking at land and the ways that Black and Indigenous communities are really starting to look at how do we take land and housing out of the speculative market, and how do we start to move, return back to an ethos of land stewardship. And so we were engaged by some amazing speakers. We had Gopal, we had Carissa, we had Hawkstorm. And so was really honored to kind of be able to hold that conversation. And I think what I would like to do today with my time is maybe use that conversation as grounding it into a body of work that I have continued to develop since then. So I'm going to go to screen share. And I'd like to use this as an opportunity to kind of share my work on restorative economics, a framework that I've been developing over the past some years, as a way of providing some context and grounding for how I enter the conversation. And so, you know, I would just really want to be explicit about lifting up that I'm entering the conversation as a Black first-generation immigrant woman. And I think that is important because the conversations that we're engaging in, while, you know, Stacey and I are putting an emphasis on economy and governance, we know that that's rooted in a social, historical, political context, which includes race and class. And so want to just like really lift up, that's my orientation to this work. And particularly because I entered the realm of engaging on economy, not just economic justice work, but particularly looking at capital and financial systems coming out of the 2008 recession. And so for those people that may have heard me speak before, I oftentimes share that the 2008 recession had a significant impact on social movement organizations, particularly those organizations that use the 501c3 model as a way of resourcing and supporting their organizers and kind of moving policy. And so what I experienced was that in 2012 is roughly around when we started to experience the delayed impacts of those recessions. And that's because so many of our organizations depend upon foundations as a primary source of income. And as foundations started to also kind of see a hit to their endowments and their bottom lines, they ended up reducing and shifting their grant-making strategies. And so this then ended up impacting the social movements on the ground. And so this is what kind of led me into figuring out how could I have a deeper understanding and analysis around what is happening in our broader economic system? How is capital moving throughout and between communities? And therefore, what does it mean in terms of our ongoing fights for racial and social justice, but also importantly, economic justice? And so to that end, I think one of the things I'd love to just kind of start off with is grounding us once again in the context of how we think about economy. And so we have an economic system that's very much rooted in extraction of natural resources, exploitation of labor, ongoing accumulation, and closure of wealth, particularly for individuals. And I would say that one of the things that I think is really evident in this moment are the ways that the compounding crises are now impacting one another. So in Oakland, California, I'm looking out my window and the skies are dark and they're ashy. And they're dark and ashy because for the past some years, we've been experiencing increased major fire events on the West Coast. And the fires that are happening up and down the coast of California, these fires are oftentimes the ones being fought by prison labor, right? So we have prisoners who are paid $1 a day to go out and fight fires on the behalf of those of us who are able to shelter in place. These are the same prisoners that were left to rot in jails, unfortunately, due to COVID-19 and the lack of commitment to provide those communities with the personal protection equipment that they need in order to address the virus. And these are the same communities that are disproportionately impacted when we look at the fact that Black and Brown communities are those that make up the majority of our prison population. So all that to say that now we're in a moment where we actually don't have the prison labor that we've relied on to fight the fires, because those are the same communities that are now losing their lives at the hand of coronavirus. And so I just think it's important for us to be able to unpack all the different ways that the ways that we've allowed capitalism and a system that's really focused in on profit maximization at any and all expense to lead us to climate disaster, to lead us to public health impacts, and unfortunately, so many of the different ways that our communities are being hurt and harmed. And so as we try to figure out how do we, you know, start to move out of a lot of the crises that impact us, I think it's important to understand that this isn't just something that we'll solve just in the economic realm. It's not something that we'll solve just in the social realm, but it's actually something where we need to integrate solutions that allow us to really figure out how do we correct the ways that our government, our democracy have been undermined, the ways that our economic system has gone unchecked, and the ways that our social values have been unfortunately compromised. And so all this to say, the work that I do first starts off at looking at how to support communities that are interested in engaging in community stewardship of assets. And specifically, I look at supporting groups of organizations, groups of people, and coming together to collectively own and manage assets. In my organizing days, and I still do quite a bit of organizing, oftentimes, particularly around community development initiatives, I witnessed the ways in which communities of color were told that you'll get a certain amount of social benefits from a development project, right? You'll get a certain amount of jobs at a certain wage rate, and you'll have a certain amount of open space. What we never really looked at was who was actually owning those spaces, who was creating those jobs, and particularly who was financially benefiting off of those development projects, right? So my work is to figure out how do we start to move away from an economic model that's focused in on individual wealth accumulation and towards models that actually start to lift up opportunities for community stewardship and collective ownership and control of assets. And that in addition to that, like Stacey laid out, the importance of being able to really look at governance, right? Being able to look explicitly at how decisions are being made and who is most directly impacted by those decisions. I don't think that it's a coincidence that as we are looking at uprisings due to the murder of George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and so many others, that as we are trying to stem off a virus that is going rampant around the world, in the United States, we're also in the midst of a very important election, right? And for so much of my early organizing career, I understood civic engagement to be going out and casting a vote every 4 years in an election. And I think that is something that we all should commit to continuing to do. And I think that casting a vote is only one element of what it means to actually govern, of what it means to have the capacity and the skills to make decisions that not only prioritize those who have the loudest voice or the most money and able to make themselves heard, but actually start to figure out how do we come together to make decisions for the collective good. When we have an economic model that's very much rooted on competition, we know that competition is kind of what got us to a lot of the problems that we're looking at. And now is an opportunity to think about collaboration. So also starting to rethink governance and starting to figure out what does it look like to support communities and being active daily stewards of the resources that shape their day-to-day lives. And that was within that, what Stacey also spoke to was understanding that we need to actually visibilize power, right? There's a way that we talk about productivity of a company in terms of just looking at the bottom line, right? That we just see that it's economic power. But understanding how economic power also translates to the political power that a community or corporation is able to have, and also the cultural power, right? Whose values and traditions do we see as worthy of investing in? And so really understanding the opportunity to start to lift up projects and models that are looking at how we collectively own and manage resources together, make decisions together that benefit the common good in service of being able to leverage those community-owned and governed assets to advance a political, economic, and cultural power-building strategy that benefit all of us. And so for me, my work on restorative economics, I would say, is very much rooted in a race and class analysis. I come to this work with a deep belief in the restorative justice and transformative justice systems and practices that are being really lifted up as an alternative to policing and mass incarceration. One of the things that I really love about the restorative justice process is that you have to start with a place of acknowledging the harm that has been done to the victims, right? And from once we can acknowledge the harm, then we can engage in a conversation on reconciliation and healing to transform those relationships, right? I think we need to be able to do the same with our economy. I think that we need to actually sit with the fact that Indigenous communities were devastated. There was a genocide that happened to Indigenous communities in which land was stolen, right? We need to sit with the fact that the enslavement of Africans is what helped to build the wealth of this country. And these are the same communities, the same Black and Brown communities that continue to be disproportionately impacted by systems and policies and practices that don't see these communities as worthy of investing in. And so before we can kind of just jump ahead to kind of creating a new economic model, I think we need to engage in a process of being grounded in the social and historical context of how we got there, how we got here. We need to repair that harm to make it possible for these communities to be a part of shaping the conversation for how we move forward. And that is actually the core element of my work. And so being able to once again sit with this piece of acknowledgement and repair. And I think that while this work is cultural and structural, it is also individual. Right? There's work that we as individuals need to do to actually see these communities as worthy of investing in. We need to actually challenge the ways that we do diligence projects, who we decide to invest in, who's able to access the resources. We need to actually look at our institutional practices, both internally but externally, to understand what is actually needed in a holistic sense to truly transform our economy. And that within that, part of the opportunity is to also, once again, sit with how do we rethink governance, right? And how do we rethink governance so that it's not just about, once again, those corporations that are able to leverage Citizens United to their benefit, or those individuals that are able to kind of donate millions of dollars to bend a candidate to their own economic needs, but starting to sit with the fact that when we center the needs of those that are most impacted, we help to make decisions that not only support that particular population, but then their friends, their families, their neighbors. This is what actually makes it better for all of us as a whole, right? So when we think about progressive tax policy, while, you know, wealthier people are asked to pay more, we understand that when we all pay our fair share in taxes, we're able to have, we're able to provide the important wages that support our social programs. We're able to have the bridges, the roads, the streetlights, all the same to help to ensure that we all have access to a meaningful, dignified quality of life. And so the ability to start to think about governance also not just as casting a vote, right, but also the process, right? Understanding the process of what it means to actually collaborate with one another, what it means to actually co-define a problem, to enact solutions, and then understand that part of the transformation is rooted in the active work of transforming our communities, right? So it's not just a passive element of telling somebody else to go out and do something, but also challenging ourselves as individuals to embody our own values and being able to enact the practices that we are expecting others to take on our behalf. So in social movements, particularly Black-led organizing, we oftentimes talk about those that are closest to the pain are best situated to identify the solutions to solve it, right? And so when we kind of sit with that as a strategy, as an understanding, then those of us that are closest to the pain are also best suited to be the ones to make the decisions, right, to implement the solutions and strategies, right, because we deeply, intimately understand what we're trying to solve together. And so starting to wrestle with governance, not just as voting, but governance is something that shapes the way we actively show up and engage with one another. And that, you know, like Stacey had laid out, that we need to be very explicit about the power, and we need to be explicit about the interconnections of our society and our system, right? So understanding that our cultural power speaks to the values and traditions that we uphold. It speaks to the norms and values of how we govern ourselves, right? And that these same norms and values are reflected then in how we move resources, particularly capital, to certain communities, right? So when Stacey talks about the fact that small mom and pop businesses, small Black and brown businesses actually weren't able to have access to the paycheck protection programs that were set out as part of a stimulus that our government enacted, it meant that we were reinforcing this value that these same Black and brown communities were not worthy of investing in, right? And so our ability to understand how our values and norms connect to the way who we invest in and how we invest in them, and the importance of being able to have a political system, being able to exercise political voice that is able to have checks and balances on our economy, that is able to actually say that as a nation that says we value democracy, democracy is not just something that happens at the ballot box, but democracy is also something that we need to see reflected in our economy. What we see happening now is that our capitalist values around profit maximization, competition, exploitation of labor, extraction of natural resources is inversely shaping our democracy, right? So when we take ballot boxes out of communities that want to do mail-in voting because of coronavirus, we are undermining our ability to live into our values of democracy. And then once again, as we kind of work from this place of how do we move from extraction and accumulation towards the regeneration and redistribution of wealth, that once again, we're sitting with the ability to redistribute power, right? To ensure that those communities that are most directly impacted have the power that they need to protect themselves and support their family, friends, and communities. And so I think it's important for us to also understand as a community that is deeply invested in economy and really rethinking of business and sitting with the challenges of financing capital, that part of our work is to also understand how can we be in direct solidarity with those social movements, those grassroots initiatives that are on the front lines of contesting for power, that are the ones that are actually leaning into a visionary stance of how we move beyond a punitive incarceral system, of how we actually start to think about not just paying people wages, but ensuring that people have access to the things that they need to live with dignity. right? And so the projects that I support, when I'm supporting a community that is thinking through a land and housing stabilization initiative, or a cooperative that's really figuring out how do we collectivize our capital and govern it together as a community, I always ask them, how are you rooted in the local social movements of your community, right? Are you looking to just personally benefit yourself, even as an organization that may be collectively owned and governed? Or are we actually leveraging our power, leveraging our assets to ensure that we're supporting those communities that are at the front lines of helping us to live into our values and our commitment to be a better democracy, committed to diversity, equity, inclusion for all? And so this is the work that I do. This is the framework that informs my consulting practice, the projects that I have a pleasure of working with, as well as the financial institutions, donors, and investors that I also have the pleasure of struggling with as we try to figure out how can we shift financial systems? How can we actually figure out a different way of doing business that supports those that are most directly impacted? So all that to say, I think those are my final comments. That is the work that I do, and I'm ready to dig into the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you so much. That was really amazing. I love your framework. I think it ties so many pieces together and really is like a useful way for us to kind of dig into those questions. And before we start off, you know, I have a question that's, I think, a theme in both of your conversations and work. And I think it's also very related to the time that we're in now, which is that I've been reflecting a lot about, you know, we all have multiple identities. You know, I'm a citizen, a consumer, a partner, a student, a daughter, and we have a tendency to try and keep those things very separate. And I think one of the things that the pandemic has done is has kind of shattered the walls between those different things and made us be whole humans. And right, and we've all been in Zoom calls with the kids jumping in and the fact that those things can't be as separate as they were before. And I think that's a powerful change, because I think that that's the first step towards changing our posture with respect to our democracy and our posture with respect to our economics. And, you know, Nwamaki, you speak about citizenship, not just as an action that you do every 4 years, but as a practice and as a way of being, and us being able to think of ourselves as citizens in our every decision, I think is an important way to start. And I think that's also something, Stacey, that you talked about in your last, in your lecture about how, you know, an owner of a small, their community, they're not just thinking of themselves as a property owner. They're also thinking of themselves as a parent and as a community member and as someone who's going to benefit from the park or who's going to suffer if the water isn't drinkable. And therefore, those identities merge and you start making decisions from a perspective of kind of a whole person. And so my first question for you is, you know, how do we start building economic models that recognize that, you know, we're entire humans and we're not just consumers? And, you know, what are some of the things that you think are required for us to move towards that kind of whole person economics?
Oh, that's a great question. I think the consumer identity has been quite ascendant for, you know, a long time in our society now, and that it has really, we think of ourselves primarily as consumers, I think, in terms of our role in the economy. And even elected officials often refer to the American consumer, you know? I mean, they're, you know, our government refers to us that way, which is a strange thing. And I think we think of ourselves that way. And, you know, you just sort of look at like the news media, the framework that we, when we think of ourselves in the economy as a consumer. And I encountered this a lot in my work. So I've been, as I mentioned, doing a lot of work on Amazon and have been writing about Amazon and about sort of the history of anti-monopoly policy and how it hasn't really been working and what it could look like if it did work and so on. And in those pieces, I'm addressing readers through the framework of their role in a self-governing society. And yet a lot of the email, almost all of the email that I get, people will say, wow, I didn't realize that about Amazon, and I'm really, this is not, you know, what I want. And so, I'm going to cancel my Prime membership, or let's get a bunch of people together and try to, or we should boycott Amazon. And I just find it really interesting, like the very first and often the only place that people go and thinking about how do I address this problem that I see is as a consumer. And as a consumer, we're incredibly weak. Like, you know, basically the choices are framed to us by somebody else, and the most we can do, I mean, it's just is incredibly limited. And the nature of monopoly power means that we don't actually have a choice in a lot of things. You know, if you want to search, if you want to fly to a particular location, whatever, there's no limited choices. So it's a very weak thing. And the more we've internalized that idea, it's had, I think, a couple of different really negative effects. One is that we've lost track of the fact that we are producers of value. And I think when we think of ourselves that way, whether we produce value through work, whether we're an entrepreneur it's all work, but, you know, our roles within our families, within our communities, we produce all of this value and do the work of making our community. And I think that having lost that perspective means that we have kind of lost the muscle of like how to sort of organize ourselves on behalf of the work that we do and what that means and the notion of kind of governing the economy. And then also this loss of citizenship, this sort of inability to even have an idea of how we might address a problem like Amazon. Despite the fact that we have this government with just this incredibly robust set of tools for making the economy fair and just, if only we would use them. They're right there. But we feel, you know, we don't go there. So how do we recover that? I mean, I think it's starting to happen a little bit more so in recent years, where people are kind of recognizing that more. But it's, you know, it feels like I keep using the phrase muscle because it does feel that way. Like it's the kind of thing that's atrophied. And so you have to sort of exercise it. And at first it's hard to like locate and like sort of figure out, and it takes a while to get going. But it has to do with participating in the civic process and really being, you know, actively engaged at the local level and, you know, even at the national level of government and within other institutions and within things like unions and cooperatives and these other structures that essentially allow for us to be collectively engaging in decision-making, which I think is part of what's going on with that consumer framework. It's very atomized and individual.
Yeah, absolutely. Momaka, did you have thoughts on that?
I do. I think what I would add to that, and I appreciate you bringing up Amazon, particularly in this moment, Stacey, is because some people have probably kind of seen the analysis around a lot of these corporations that have amassed large amounts of wealth in this moment, right? And they have done this while we see people being evicted out of their homes, even though there's supposed to be moratoriums on evictions. We see these companies and corporations making so much money. And at the same time, people don't think that protesters should be angry about the unchecked, unaccountable deaths and murders of Black people. And they call them looters. And part of why I lift this up is because when we think about moving, not just engaging people as sectoral-based, as one issue-based entities, but we actually understand that we can no longer be politically neutral. And so the response that a lot of people had, like Stacey said, right, is like, well, we need to go boycott Amazon. And it's like that could be one approach. And the other thing is, how do we deepen our political analysis to understand why a people would be so upset that they would start to burn down a city, right? Right. And people oftentimes look at this type of uprising and say, you know, well, why are you burning down these businesses? These aren't their businesses. These are places where we are watched when we go into shops. These are places where we're told we don't belong. And when you're so dislocated from your own labor, right? When we talk about the productive capacity of labor that's been reduced to a wage and having to fight for a minimum wage, right? Minimum wage is what is the bare minimum that you need to survive, to live. So all that to say, our ability to look at these issues, these crises as things that are compounded and not just as separate from one another, but understanding that we, when we engage both economically, we are engaging politically. And so we actually don't get to remain neutral and we don't get to remain ignorant because there is no neutrality when you have systems that are inherently unjust in how they were designed and developed. So really inviting people to be bold and brave political actors, really inviting our financial systems to move resources in a way that we're not forced to deny or ignore an element of who we are in our experiences. So, you know, I oftentimes think about the ways that formerly incarcerated individuals that are returning home to their low-income neighborhoods are not able to live at the affordable housing complex of their family and friends, right? And so when housing comes up against what it means to be somebody who has served time and is returning, we deny the fact that these are the people that actually need housing. When we look at veterans that are returning back to the United States and are not able to kind of go to the mailbox to get their medication because we've actually pulled and disrupted the postal services, we don't actually see these people as worthy of being cared for and taken care of by our government. We see them as things to be exploited and as things to kind of continue to protect the accumulation of wealth and power. And so I think that this is a really important question in terms of how we start to look at people and communities as whole. And I think some of the exciting initiatives that really move me towards this direction are, you know, universal basic income is something that Andrew Yang really popularized as he was running for president in the United States. And I think it's not, I have an assessment about UBI. I don't think it's meant to be, you know, flat all around. All that to say, I think it's an interesting tool to start to experiment with this question of what does it mean to trust people to have access to the resources that they need to make decisions for themselves and their families. So there's a project in Jackson called the Magnolia Mothers Trust, led by an amazing, inspiring individual, Aisha Ndoro. And they have provided mothers $1,200 a month. And this flexible cash that's not tied to how many hours they're working, that's not tied to where they live, that's not tied to their education or status, allows them to make decisions where they're now, the group has come together to actually create a savings account for their children. And so when we trust people to make decisions, when we see people as whole and deserving of being cared for just by the virtue that they are human beings, I think that it invites us to access our humanity and really challenge the ways that we've looked at stretching our society as something focused in on profit maximization.
Thank you. So I'm going to go to a question from the audience. We have a great question here, which is, how can we actually change who holds power and access to financial resources? You know, how can we ensure that we're not just resourcing a handful of nationally known organizations, and when there are thousands of locally focused deserving organizations as well? And I think this is an important question because we have these roots of power that have been established, you know, and there's roots, there's organizations that get support and that are easy to support. We know about them. I think doing the work of resourcing a decentralized field of organizations nationwide is harder for donors and investors, but is also so necessary. So I'd love to hear your thoughts on that question. Stacey.
I feel like that's a great question for Noah Kama, actually.
Okay.
Sure, I'm happy to jump into it, and I would start by actually referencing Stacey, your TED Talk. You had done a talk where you talked about the importance of supporting local businesses because there's a level of relationship there that is just so important for thinking about how we engage. And so I think relationships are actually extremely important. Being able to have relationships when possible with the organizations that are local, but also having an understanding of what is the connectivity of national organizations to grassroots entities. And so one of the organizations I've been honored to support through some of my philanthropic work is the Movement for Black Lives. The Movement for Black Lives brings together 150 different Black-led organizing groups across the country. And the ability to resource them as an ecosystem of Black-led organizing that's connected to to organizations in particular places. And so moving resources to them in a way that they're able to then redistribute those funds to groups on the ground because they have that level of trust and relationship. They understand what type of work needs to be organized, and they're actively in community together, right? So even as we see groups doing local work to defund the police, all of this builds up to the ability to kind of engage in a national conversation around these issues. And so that to say, I also directly support local Black-led organizations here in Oakland, right? The organizations that, you know, back when we could be outside and knock on doors, also being able to be in direct relationship with them. So there's a level of assessment that I think people need to lean into in terms of who is closest to you that you have relationship with, that you feel is values aligned, that you can resource, and also understanding the ability to support organizations that are coming together to create an ecosystem and aggregate their ability to raise funds to redistribute out to their communities so they can have a collective action. You know, I also think about groups like the NDN Collective that was recently in the news, given the attack that their founder, Nick Tilson, sustained, you know, after trying to defend Mount Rushmore, right? And so, but the ability to have NDN as a group that is supporting the Lakota Territory in South Dakota, and that's also in relationship to a number of other indigenous communities across the country. It's important for there to be relationship even while we want to, even while the local work is essential and important.
One thing I would add to that, or a sort of perspective, is I've been involved in the last couple of years in helping to form a broad national coalition around restructuring Amazon and sort of reimagining kind of e-commerce in a way that respects communities and work and small independent businesses and democracy. And it's a coalition that's grown to, I think, more than 50 organizations now. And we raise money to fund the work collectively. Some of the groups within also raise money around the work, but we raise money as a coalition. We have a little bit of a central staff and then also re-grant out to carry out our collective strategy. And as a sort of deliberate part of how we designed our principles around that re-granting is a recognition that we had to correct for like historical imbalances in who gets funding between small groups and large groups, between white-led and Black-led, between grassroots and not grassroots. And so we have a set of principles where we recognize that leadership from impacted communities is really critical to the success of the campaign. And so part of what we do as a coalition is we, you know, set out a set of principles that really prioritize that. And so the money that we're sort of able to raise at a national level is being directed through a whole bunch of local and grassroots organizations. So that's one entity by which, you know, you can accomplish a little bit of that, and of course, there are many others.
Thank you. And we have a great follow-up question here, which is, you know, do you have some good examples of the vision that you're offering, each of you, like, you know, some examples to bring this to life of municipalities or communities that are developing such kind of local grass, you know, economic models?
We just released something called Fighting Monopoly Power, and it's a guide that you can find on our website, an online guide to state and local strategies around limiting corporate control and strengthening buildings for thriving communities. And it's organized by sector, so food and farming, broadband, energy, and is both each sector, there's a look at like how, what are the trend lines, what is the structure and nature of how this sector operates now, what are the major policies that govern it, and then a set of a whole bunch of very practical local and state policies and programs that can take power back and sort of restructure it in a more democratic way. So there are a lot of great examples within that. Some of those that are coming to mind right now, we've worked with a bunch of communities around building either community-owned or municipally-owned broadband, which is faster and cheaper and benefits economic development, yes, and becomes much more responsive. I mean, it's a way to have universal service. It's a way to redress inequities because it's controlled by the community and is run by a set of values that is different than the values that Charter or Time Warner or whoever brings to internet service. Other examples, the Bank of North Dakota is a really terrific example, publicly owned bank that actually provides a kind of wholesale function to local banks and credit unions. And one result of it is that 80% of the deposits in North Dakota are held by local banks and credit unions, and they have a much higher level of lending and capital being delivered to small local businesses and farms than in other states because they have a banking system that is very much locally controlled, and that's the result of this sort of public kind of wholesale or banker's bank. There are a number of cities, Oakland, Philadelphia, a few other places that are looking at that model to do at a municipal level. One other thing that's kind of interesting from North Dakota, while I'm thinking about it, just to give one other example, a number of years ago, North Dakota prohibited, basically said, if you want to operate a pharmacy, you have to be a pharmacist. And the result is that there are no pharmacies in Walmart stores. There are no pharmacies in chain supermarkets. There's no Walgreens, no CVS in North Dakota. Every pharmacy is a locally owned independent pharmacy. And we did a report, an analysis of this a few years ago, and found that North Dakota pays some of the lowest prescription drug prices in the country. They have incredibly wide access to pharmacies. Like, they have far more pharmacies per capita than any other state. And if you compare North Dakota to South Dakota, which is kind of similar in terms of its geography and population distribution, in the very tiniest towns in North Dakota, you're twice as likely to have a local pharmacy than in the tiny towns in South Dakota. And these pharmacies are really centers for these small communities of health care. Like, they deliver a wide range of healthcare services. It's an interesting model, but they've basically said, no, we want healthcare decisions controlled by people who are healthcare professionals and not by corporations. And in fact, by sort of empirical measures or any sort of measure you can think of, are better off as a result.
Yeah, I would enthusiastically second the examples of the North Dakota Public Bank and even the community-owned and controlled Wi-Fi system. And I think one of the things I would lift up in that example is that there's a level of resilience in things that are community-owned and governed and managed, right? So Red Hook Wi-Fi, a community-owned and managed Wi-Fi system in New York, was the only remaining internet service provided to communities for a 7-mile radius when Hurricane Sandy hit, right? And so when we think about what it means for communities to intimately understand the infrastructure, the connectivity, to be able to manage it and govern it, it also allows us to kind of weather the increasing natural disasters and climate chaos that we're experiencing. I think the other thing that I would add in terms of the examples that I'm most excited about, probably really clear to folks that the models that I focus in on are those that are at the grassroots community level. And specifically, I look to support projects in a few different areas that help to create community wealth. So I'm very interested in those communities that are looking at community governed vehicles. And these are projects like Seed Commons, a national cooperative of cooperative loan funds that are aggregating capital to support and redistribute to cooperative businesses across the country. I think of Boston Ujima out of Boston, Massachusetts, a very local community governed loan fund once again that's supporting grassroots communities, organizers, and entrepreneurs and businesses and coming together to figure out what are the businesses that we want to have in our local community and how do we want to resource them so that they can continue to be a part of the fabric of our society. I also think about, in addition to Wi-Fi, I think microgrid energy infrastructure systems are also extremely important. When we look at major utilities like PG&E, in California, that it doesn't meet their bottom line to actually maintain the power lines that are the root a lot of the rolling fires and blackouts that we've been experiencing. And so projects like the People Solar Energy Fund that is also aggregating capital to support community owned infrastructure projects that are focused in on renewable energy is extremely exciting. Black Land and Power is another initiative that brings together Black-led land-based institutions, farmers in urban and rural areas, food justice organizers to figure out how do we really look at maintaining land and taking it out of the speculative market and really preserving it for the stewardship of Black communities. And so all these different examples are ways that people are really trying to wrestle with how do we come together with our collective power to make decisions that support our communities? And so those are just, you know, a few examples that I would lift up that I think are really inspiring. And I would lift up these examples to offer that I hope that they can serve as a source of inspiration. I think oftentimes we want to go to a place of scalability and replicability, and there's just so much beauty in smallness. There's beauty in the level of relationships that can happen on a local level. And when we, the desire to replicate things, we should also understand that what I think makes sense in Oakland with the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative may not make sense in San Antonio. And so rather than saying, let's actually take this thing and replicate it, how can we learn from it and then use that model to understand how to engage it in the social, political, historical context of a people in a particular place?
Yep. So I'm looking at the time. We have about 20 minutes left, and I would love to make some time for you to ask each other questions. I know you have excellent questions, so whoever wants to go first, but let's spend some time doing that.
I will ask you a question first, if that's okay, Stacey. So one of the things that, you know, I've been sitting with as we have conversations around essential businesses and essential workers is really trying to figure out how do we resource and support these businesses, not just in like a 9-month window, but understanding that what we'll experience from the pandemic, you know, it's roughly 2 years they'll tell us until we'll have a vaccine. And we also know that some elements of an economic recession are still moving in waves. So all this to say, I'm curious around, like, what do you see as some of the most successful ways to support the essential workers, the essential businesses, that we still want to be a part of a vibrant local economy so that we're not all just kind of engaging with the Whole Foods and the Amazon?
Oh, that's a great question, Amaka. This is a potentially sort of extinction level event for like large sections of small businesses and local economies. You know, when we back in March, when things really started to unfold with the pandemic, we brought together a group of allies and local and, you know, independent business organizations that we work with, and had a sort of set of things that we asked for. And I guess just to step back for a moment, like the answer to your question of like where, you know, who has, what are the best models out there? They're unfortunately in other countries. There are some interesting things going on locally here, but I will just, you know, I feel compelled to note that several countries, most European countries, Canada as well, adopted national programs where they essentially said, because you are shut down or, you know, substantially impaired by the public health crisis, we're going to step in and just do a direct cash infusion to cover a substantial amount of your core costs. And they define core costs typically as your payroll and like your occupancy, like your rent, your utilities. Like, so we, you know, at the very least, we keep the business as a productive asset intact. in terms of the people and the location, the physical location. And we'll do that off and on, maybe as long as it takes, you know, maybe ramping up and down with varying degrees of shutdowns and so on until we're at the end of this crisis and you can count on that. And that's the right response and is in general what we called for back in March. We said, you know, it can't be a loan program. We can't saddle all those businesses with debt. It does need to be grants. It needs to be direct cash assistance that's delivered, you know, through the Treasury, because the Treasury through IRS interfaces with every business. They all, you know, they all pay some form of taxes, basically. And it needs to be durable through the course of this crisis. And what we got at the federal level, again, was the, of course, was the Paycheck Protection Program, which was basically a grant program. So there was to some degree of good news on that front. It wasn't just a loan, but it was short-term and temporary and limited in what you could use it for and limited in duration and delivered through the banking system, you know, which just through the SBA, which is a rickety organization, agency of the Small Business Administration, through the banking system, and has created this just incredibly uneven level of distribution of funds. And even for those who got funds, you know, is limited, and now we're just in this like free fall zone and no one knows what's going to happen. There's incredible uncertainty, and there's so many I'm worried about, particularly like the next 4 to 8 weeks, because now that we're sort of coming out of summer where it was possible to do some things outside, you know, many regions of the country are going to start to get cold again. It's unclear how long this is all going to last. There seems to be nothing more coming. And a lot of business owners are going to say, I'm not going to go further into debt. I can't do that. Or they're going to come for my house, you know, or, you know, it's just and on and on. So I'm really worried about what we're going to see in the coming weeks. And, you know, just to put some figures on this, you know, as of April, the number of active Black-owned businesses in this country had fallen by 41%, which is astonishing. And in the, you know, among white-owned businesses, it was about 20%. And that was in April. You know, I don't know where we are right now. So that's the failure at the federal level. There are still good proposals. Pramila Jayapal, who's a congresswoman from Washington, has a very good a bill. There are others who have good bills, and possibly maybe they will come back. At the local level, there have been a lot of cities who've really stepped in, and in some cases, like, found money. You know, I saw one city that where they had foregone like raises for city councilors, you know, to like siphon off money, or taken money out of like corporate tax giveaways and like shifted that over into small business relief programs. Lots of cities have been adjusting permitting, allowing people to do stuff on the street and outside. And, you know, so at the local level, there has been a lot that has happened, and, you know, several billion dollars has been marshaled in relief and a lot of sort of support and flexibility. And we actually did just do a report called 26 takeaways or strategies for local leaders to help small businesses weather the pandemic. So a colleague of mine, Kennedy Smith, evaluated about 700 of these programs nationally and put together like sort of the best takeaways along with other ideas. And it's kind of organized between like, what do you need to do immediately? And then what are the more systemic things you need to fix and so on. So it's a really good report that highlights many of those good ideas. But it is just sort of troubling because at that level, it's not enough. And by any stretch of the imagination, and it's uneven in the sense that it's dependent on local resources. And so if you're in a poor community or in a city where low-income people of color lack political power, you know, it's not going to be there. And so I think, you know, it raises for me, I think one of the things that I wrestle with a lot in my work, and I'd be, you know, really interested, Amaka, in how you think about this, is sort of what is, you know, when do we think about local solutions and when do we think about sort of federal solutions? And, you know, given these incredible extremes in inequality and sort of depletion within some communities, you know, how do we redress that? And in some ways it does, I do feel like we need some national muscle and redistribution and reparation and so on to do that. At the same time that I'm, you know, obviously a really big champion of local solutions, and I sort of struggle going back and forth about where to focus the time. And I'm really curious how you think about that.
Yeah, I wish I had a good answer for you, Stacey. I think where I sit with it as somebody who's also worked on federal and state policy and even local policy is it's all a both and, unfortunately, because you know, cities are all different. We may have elected officials on the local level that are willing and able to enact something that our federal representatives might not, and vice versa. And one of the things that has stood out to me in this current political moment and social moment is the fact that, you know, a number of different communities that have been organizing around abolition and defunding the police have been doing that work for a decade plus years. And so there's ways that we organize and do our work that ready us for a moment when we're able to actually then engage on a more national stage. And so being willing to hold the tension between both those strategies, being able to be in enough relationship with national but also local efforts as well, so we're able to be in communication with one another, even if we're not doing the same exact tactics, right? We have an awareness of how each other is engaging, because we never know when the moment comes that people are ready to be activated. Who would have known that, you know, coming off of Ferguson and Mike Brown, that we would now be in a moment where the calls to defund the police state, the calls to have accountability on state-sanctioned violence, the really challenging of, like, really looking at the ways that the military has been brought in, you know, cities like Portland to attack peaceful protesters would be the thing that would activate people. And so I think that there's a lot to be learned from local tactics to federal tactics. And once again, I think it comes back to relationship and our willingness to be engaged and our commitment to stretch ourselves. It does ask a lot of us to both stay up to date on the federal news. It asks a lot of us to understand what's happening with our neighbors. And it's that level of vigilance that we need to really protect our democracy. But it sounds like you're already doing a good job of it. And I think, you know, we are learning from grassroots organizations that have continued to be in it. And the other thing I'll say, the last thing I'll say on this piece, I think it comes back to Neve's previous question around how we move out of issue-based work, is that we understand that this work is just a part of our experience and who we are as people that are directly impacted in these particular moments. And most of us can't help but engage and work and fight on all these different fronts. And so that's both the disproportionate burden, but also the opportunity for how we come out of this together.
That's great. I wonder if I could ask you another question, which is, you know, I really was sort of sparked in thinking about some of your work around the notion of ownership, like ownership of land and needing to move away from that. And I guess sort of struggling a little bit in my own mind, thinking about, I guess, maybe two different dimensions of it. Some of it is around ownership maybe versus stewardship. And I don't know how you think about those, like, but then there's also the collective versus the individual in both cases. And I'm curious if you think about, like, there are kinds of assets that necessitate or should be kind of collectively stewarded, and other assets that can or should be more individually controlled. I'm just curious about both those sort of ownership and stewardship and collective and individual, and how do you think about that?
Yes, I love the nuance and the layering of the questions, because I don't think that there's one right answer. I think, you know, when I sit with this question, I come back to this piece that you had referenced earlier around productivity. And I think that there are some places, some assets in our society where we should actually look at them as productive assets, not to be extracted from, particularly because they can't be renewed. And so when we look at like the desertification, I have a hard time saying that word, of green spaces, we know that land is a resource that can't be renewed. And so what does it mean to actually look at that as a productive asset to be protected and stewarded, to be managed and maintained, rather than something to be extracted from and destroyed and denigrated so that we can kind of get monetary profit? So I try to sit with this more on the aspects of what is the asset generating? What can it generate? And who is being harmed, or what is being harmed at the expense of extracting from that asset? And so once again, I think there's places where we have seen where there's cooperatives. I look at groups like the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative in Oakland, California, working to kind of preserve land and housing in a bloated real estate market. And I look at the fact that this is an organization that's in deep relationship with Black brown communities that need access to housing. And so all that to say, I think that there's, you know, moments where we also look at initiatives. We look at the East Bay Permanent Real Estate Cooperative in the same conversation. We look at the Oakland Community Land Trust that helps to support Black and brown homeowners get access to housing. And so that home is technically directly owned by that singular family. But the way that they're in relationship to each other, the way that the land is being preserved for the productive benefit of the community, is part of the nuance that I think we get to kind of bring into the conversation. And so whether we're looking at financial institutions, banks, whether we're looking at investment markets and 401ks, land or businesses, I'm always kind of sitting with where is the value and wealth being extracted from and who is that being extracted by? So are we actually looking to pay workers below the minimum wage so that the business owner can continue to generate profits? Are we actually, you know, making cooperative cleaning programs use polluting cleaning products? That's not helpful to the worker. And so I'm always trying to sit with developing the capacity to discern where we can commit to our values of do no harm, and how to actually hold that in conjunction with the fact that, you know, we're coming to the ends of all that we get to access and share together. And so how do we hold that together? Over 2 minutes. I didn't even get to ask you a question, Stacey. I was talking too much. I'm sorry.
Well, you asked me about PPP. Protection program. Yeah. I think that's great. I'll just one quick thing on that is I think the real estate, the land and buildings piece is really right, because I'm all in favor of like worker co-ops and credit unions and food co-ops and so on. But there's also an aspect of business that's creative, and a lot of like creative endeavors are done individually, writing a novel, painting a painting, you know? And so there are ways in which businesses can also be like an individual thing, and that's great. But I think the community ownership part of it has to be around like the real estate and the commercial districts, because then we control those assets and create space for the kind of businesses that we want. And as the value increases, it accrues to the community. And it's like a nice way to balance like the sort of the need for more collective and community ownership with like space for individual expression and sort of pursuing an enterprise on one's own.
That's great. Thank you so much. We are getting to time, so I'm going to move to our last question, which is in Schumacher tradition. Could you each share some closing thoughts about what keeps your spirits lifted in these challenging times?
I tried to think of a more sophisticated answer to this question, but I'll tell you what came to mind. Which is, you know, I'm in Maine in Portland, and it's blueberry season. So I made this beautiful blueberry cake, and that to me was like sort of the highlight of my week. And it's that kind of stuff that, you know, that it's for me is like very kind of nourishing, both the part of like going to the farmer's market and getting the blueberries and making the cake and sharing it, you know, is the stuff that makes it all possible.
I want to have some of this blueberry cake. yeah, I mean, I always find it so fascinating that we end on this question, because honestly, I think it's the community of Schumacher, right? The fact that we get to be in conversation with people that can both hold the complexity of the challenges facing the communities that we work with, but still continue to commit ourselves to the fight and embody our values. And so I think, you know, the projects that are happening on the ground, the ways that people continue to show up on a day-to-day basis to continue to resist, but also to build and imagine the futures that we want together, I think those are the things, you know, that hold me and give me hope. So, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I echo that fully. I love that about the conversations that we're able to hold, that I think they're real, and yet we're imagining also, you know, what I like to call pockets of the present and the future, like pockets of the future and the present. All of these models that we see in the different places where we work that I think are imagining a world that could be different. And it's all about linking those all together to see what can come out of it. So I want to thank you both for taking the time and for taking the time today and just in general for the work you do day in and day out to help set us on a different course. And I also wanted to thank the whole Schumacher team that's been working in the background to make this a seamless experience, monitoring your questions and taking care of all the logistics.
Thank you for listening to the Schumacher Conversations. To hear more from visionary thinkers in the new economy movement and to discover 40 years worth of Schumacher lectures, visit our website at centerforneweconomics.org. You can strengthen our mission to bring about a just and sustainable global economy by making a donation at centerforneweconomics.org/donate or by purchasing pamphlets of your favorite lectures at centerforneweconomics.org/order-pamphlets.